Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show built to take your stack of research, all those articles, notes, and studies, and really pull out the strategic knowledge you need to be well-informed.
Yeah, and today we are doing the Capstone Deep Dive in our series on cardiovascular optimization.
That's right. So in our previous deep dives, we really laid out the foundation. We talked about the non-negotiables.
Sleep quality, structured exercise, diet, supplements, the big stuff.
Exactly. But today, we're moving past the basics. We're going into what the research community is now calling the second tier of factors.
And that's where it gets really interesting.
Okay, so let's unpack that. When we say second tier, what are we talking about?
We're talking about things like heat exposure, social connection, even specific breathing protocols, and having a sense of purpose in life.
And the mission for this deep dive is to be, well, really rigorously analytical. We've all seen headlines suggesting these factors can have effect sizes as big as traditional risk factors.
Or even some medications, yeah. But we need to actually verify that evidence.
Right. So our goal is to evaluate the evidence hierarchy. We want to draw a really clear line.
A line between what we're calling tier A support, that's rock solid, hard outcome data that shows a real reduction in events like heart attacks and strokes.
And on the other side.
And on the other side, the things where popular enthusiasm, you know, often fueled by marketing, has just vastly outpaced the actual science. We'll put those in tier C.
That distinction is so critical. Before we jump in, let's quickly define a few terms. These are straight from the sources because precision really matters here.
For sure. We'll be using these a lot. First up, CVD. That just means cardiovascular disease. It's a broad term for anything affecting the heart and blood vessels.
Okay, CVD. Got it.
Then there's SCD. That stands for sudden cardiac death. This is often, you know, the most dramatic and devastating outcome the studies track.
And the next one is something people might have heard of but not fully understand, HRV.
Right. Heart rate variability.
Damn.
And to be clear, this is not your heart rate. It's the healthy variation in the amount of time between your heartbeats.
So more variability is good.
Exactly. It reflects the flexibility and the health of your autonomic nervous system. It's a key marker of resilience.
Okay. And then the last one for when we get to environmental factors later.
We might mention NDVI. It stands for Normalized Difference Vegetation Index.
Which is a fancy way of saying.
It's basically a scientific satellite-based measure that researchers use to quantify how much green space or, you know, residential greenness there is in a specific area.
Perfect. Knowing those terms will let us get into the deep mechanisms without getting bogged down.
Excellent. So with our terms in place, let's start with what is probably the most dramatic and counterintuitive finding in all our sources.
This is the one that really shifts how you view passive lifestyle changes.
It does. We're talking about the unexpected power of heat. Specifically, what the research calls the Finnish anomaly.
Okay, so the Finnish anomaly. This is anchored in a really famous study, right?
One of the most respected, yeah. A long-term prospective cohort study called the Kuopio Ischemic Heart Disease Risk Factor Study, or the KIHD study for short.
And this has been going on for a while.
A long while. They started tracking 2,315 middle-aged Finnish men all the way back in 1984. The follow-up period is well over 20 years now.
And the cultural context here is absolutely key, isn't it? In Finland, sauna use is not some new wellness fad.
Not at all. It's a fundamental, deeply integrated, lifelong practice. I mean, it often starts in childhood.
Mm.
And that provides a really unique natural laboratory for studying chronic heat exposure.
So what did they find? The study tracked these men based on how often they use a sauna.
And the main finding is just astonishing. They found that regular sauna use was associated with a massive reduction in sudden cardiac death, the deadliest outcome.
Okay, give us the numbers, because when I first read them, they were hard to believe.
They really are. Men who use the sauna 4 to 7 times per week had a stunning 63% lower risk of sudden cardiac death compared to the men who only went once a week.
63%.
63%. That translates to a hazard ratio of 0.37. And just to give that some context for you, a 63% reduction from a non-drug lifestyle factor is extraordinary.
It's huge. That's the kind of number you see from aggressively treating high blood pressure or cholesterol with multiple medications.
Exactly. And that's an immense strategic lesson right out of the gate.
What I found really compelling, what sort of cemented this as a potential causal link, was the clear dose-response relationship they found.
Yes. That's how you build confidence in causality from observational data. You look for that graded response. It wasn't just a binary, you know, use it or don't kind of effect.
So more was better.
Much better. The men going 2 to 3 times per week, they saw a meaningful but smaller 27% benefit, a 27% reduction in SCD.
Still great.
Still great. But it was that maximum frequency, 4 to 7 times weekly, that delivered that incredible 63% protective effect. The more intense the intervention, the bigger the benefit.
And it wasn't just about how often you went. The duration of the session mattered too.
It did. The study noted that sessions that went longer than 19 minutes gave additional protection over and above those who had shorter exposures.
Which implies that your body needs enough time to really heat up, to elevate its core temperature and trigger these deep cellular adaptations we're about to get into.
Precisely. And while the original KIHD study was on men, later research found similar benefits in women.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's not sex specific?
Not at all. Subsequent data showed that women who used the sauna 4 to 7 times a week had a 77% lower cardiovascular mortality rate compared to those who only went once a week.
Wow, even higher.
A bit, yeah. The protective mechanism seems really robust across both sexes, which just reinforces why we have to put this in tier A.
That KIHD data is so compelling, it immediately puts sauna use in tier A. So let's get into the why. What are the underlying physiological mechanisms? Because this is obviously about way more than just, you know, sweating out toxins.
Oh, absolutely. This is about cellular repair. You can really think of this as a form of passive cardiovascular conditioning.
Passive conditioning, I like that.
The acute stressor of the heat triggers this whole protective cascade. And it primarily revolves around the activation of something called heat shock proteins, or HSPs.
Heat shock proteins, what exactly do they do once the heat turns them on?
Well, they're like the cell's dedicated repair crew. They're multifunctional. First, they act as what we call molecular chaperones. They find damaged proteins and help refold them back into their correct functional shape.
Which is critical for long-term cell health.
Absolutely. Second, and this is key for cardiovascular health, they stabilize the production and the effectiveness of nitric oxide in your blood vessels.
And nitric oxide is the master regulator of how relaxed or constricted your blood vessels are.
It is. And the third major role is managing inflammation. This is vital.
How do they do that?
HSPs actively suppress that chronic, low-grade inflammation that drives so much disease. They do it, in part, by inhibiting a key inflammatory pathway called NFKB.
Okay, NFKB. That stands for Nuclear Factor Capillate Chain Enhancer of Activated B Cells. A mouthful.
It is. But what you need to know is that when NFKB is chronically active, it promotes the hardening of your arteries. It promotes plaque buildup. So by inhibiting it, HSPs directly fight the biological root of atherosclerosis.
So on a cellular level, heat is turning off the inflammation switch and turning on the repair switch. What about the immediate effects you feel, the effects on the whole cardiovascular system?
Acutely, the heat exposure mimics moderate intensity exercise. Your body has to dissipate all that heat to cool its core.
Right.
So it initiates this massive peripheral vasodilation. The blood vessels in your skin and your limbs widen significantly.
And that causes your blood pressure to drop.
An immediate acute drop in systemic blood pressure, or BP. And at the same time, your heart rate increases to maintain circulation and pump all that blood to the surface for cooling.
And there's that passive conditioning again. It's a workout for your heart and your blood vessels, but without any of the joint impact.
Precisely. And the research validates this. It shows a real improvement in vascular flexibility. Studies on regular heat therapy documented a key marker of vascular health. It's called flow-mediated dilation, or FMD.
FMD? How much did it improve?
Dramatically.
Yeah.
FMD, which measures how elastic your arteries are, went from an initial reading of 5.6% to a really robust 10.9%. And that was after just 8 weeks of regular sauna use.
That's a doubling of endothelial function in just 2 months. And endothelial function is arguably the single best predictor of your long-term cardiovascular prognosis.
It is. And the chronic effects just reinforce this. Extended follow-up of that same KIHD cohort confirmed that the chronic regular users had a 47% reduced incidence of hypertension over time.
Wow. So the short-term blood pressure drops translate into long-term blood pressure control.
They do. And on top of that, regular use significantly lowers key inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein, or CRP, and interleukin-6.
This all positions heat as an incredibly valuable tool, especially for people who might be, you know, physically unable to do traditional exercise. But we have to come back to the big challenge here, the intellectual honesty check.
The Finnish anomaly.
Right. If this data is so powerful, why hasn't this been adopted everywhere around the globe?
And that is the major limitation we have to confront. all of that major long-term outcome data, that phenomenal 63% reduction in sudden cardiac death, it all comes from that one single culturally integrated Finnish cohort.
So we can't definitively separate the biological effect of the heat from what researchers call healthy user bias.
Exactly. What does that healthy user bias look like in Finland? It means that the kind of person who consistently uses a sauna 4 to 7 times a week might just be fundamentally different from someone who only goes once.
They might be more health conscious in general.
Right. They might be less likely to smoke, more likely to take their medication, have a higher socioeconomic status, even after the researchers try to statistically adjust for those things.
And the ritual itself might be bundled with other factors, like social connection, maybe.
It could be. And we saw this contradiction really starkly when independent researchers tried to apply this somewhere else.
The gold standard in medical research, the randomized controlled trial, or RCT?
Yes. A 2025 RCT tried to replicate these findings in a non-Finnish population. And they found, and I'm quoting, no significant improvements in most cardiometabolic markers.
So that creates genuine scientific uncertainty. If the intervention doesn't show the same benefits when you test it in a different culture, you have to ask the question.
Is it the heat or is it the culture surrounding the heat?
But hold on. Can we really rely on one single short-term RCT that failed when we have over 2 decades of really strong prospective cohort data? Does failing to improve surrogate markers negate the reduction in hard outcomes?
And that is the very heart of the scientific debate. These short-term RCTs, they're often only 8 or 12 weeks long. That might just not be long enough to capture the chronic adaptive cellular benefits that could take years, maybe even decades, to build up.
Like we saw in the 20-year KAHD study.
Right. So we just have to acknowledge that while the Finnish data is absolutely tier A, the generalizability to, say, an American using an infrared sauna in their basement is not yet tier A proven.
Understood. So, based strictly on the protocols that were verified in the KAHD data, what is the practical advice for someone listening who does have access to a sauna?
The dosing recommendations are very clear. You want to aim for that 4 to 7 times per week frequency to really maximize the benefit.
And for how long?
Duration should be between 15 and 20 minutes per session. Make sure you get past that 19-minute threshold we mentioned.
And temperature. Does it matter if it's a traditional sauna versus an infrared one?
So traditional Finnish saunas operate between 80 to 100 degrees Celsius. That's about 176 to 212 Fahrenheit. Infrared saunas operate lower, maybe around 60 Celsius or 140 Fahrenheit. But they have shown similar mechanistic benefits, like improving that FMD metric. So they're a viable alternative if the high heat is too much.
And we absolutely have to include a critical reminder on safety. We are intentionally stressing the cardiovascular system here.
This is non-negotiable. Anyone with unstable angina, a recent heart attack, a myocardial infarction, or severe aortic stenosis should avoid heat therapy completely.
And for everyone else.
Adequate hydration is essential, and the sources are explicit. Do not combine sauna use with alcohol. The vasodilation from the heat and the alcohol together just significantly increases the strain on the heart and the risk of arrhythmia.
Okay, let's shift gears completely. We're moving from physical heat stress to chronic emotional stress, our second tier A factor, social connection and isolation.
And this is a risk factor that the medical establishment has, well, only recently started to take as seriously as it should.
It's gotten a major upgrade, hasn't it?
A huge overdue upgrade. In 2022, the American Heart Association, the AHA, issued a landmark scientific statement.
What did it say?
It formally elevated social isolation and loneliness to the status of major modifiable cardiovascular risk factors. They scientifically place them on par with traditional dangers like smoking, physical inactivity, or uncontrolled hypertension.
That's a massive reframing. It turns connection from a soft skill into a hard cardiovascular intervention.
It does. And the data they use to quantify the risk, it completely backs up that aggressive stance.
The numbers are huge.
They're massive. The authoritative Holt-Lundstad meta-analysis, this thing consolidated 148 studies covering nearly 309,000 people. It demonstrated that having strong social relationships was associated with a remarkable 50% increase in the odds of survival.
50%. A 50% increase in survival odds. That rivals the long-term benefit of quitting smoking. I mean, an effect size like that demands our attention.
And when you look specifically at cardiovascular outcomes, the risks are just as stark. Social isolation is independently linked to a 29% increased risk of coronary heart disease, with CHD.
And stroke.
And a 32% increased risk of stroke. And for people who already have heart disease, isolation can predict a 2- to 3-fold increase in mortality within just 5 or 6 years. Loneliness is literally lethal.
What's fascinating here, and I think extremely relevant for a lot of our listeners, is the critical sex difference the research consistently finds.
The difference is striking. It really suggests men are disproportionately vulnerable to this.
How so?
The UK Biobank research, which analyzed over 322,000 people, found that social isolation increased cardiovascular mortality by a staggering 61% in men.
61%.
And in women.
Compared to a 32% increase in women. And this finding, that the association is stronger in men, it shows up again and again across numerous studies.
Which might explain some of the historical data, like from the Framingham Offspring study. It showed that married men had 46% lower death rates than unmarried men, even after adjusting for all the classic heart risks. It does. And this leads us right to the idea of purpose. A lot of the research, including the Japanese Ikigai studies, reinforces this. The protective effects of purpose and connection are strongest and often only significant in men.
Particularly which men?
Particularly unemployed or retired men. And this flags the retirement transition as an acute cardiovascular risk window, especially for men.
So you're saying the sudden loss of your professional identity, the workplace structure, the daily social contact, that can act as a severe acute cardiovascular risk factor. It's like suddenly developing high blood pressure overnight.
That's exactly it. So proactively cultivating sources of purpose and social connection outside of your job, well, before you retire, that isn't just good life advice. It is a profound cardiovascular intervention.
Okay, so how does loneliness physically damage the heart? What is the actual biological pathway that makes isolation a tier A risk factor?
The core mechanism is chronic stress and inflammation. Isolation chronically activates the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or the HPA axis.
The body's main stress response system.
Right. And this leads to perpetually elevated cortisol levels, and it disrupts the healthy, predictable daily rhythm of your cortisol cycle.
And what does that constant stress response do inside your blood vessels?
It creates a state of systemic, low-grade inflammation. The key inflammatory marker that is consistently elevated in isolated people is interleukin-6. Or IL-6.
And IL-6 is bad news for your arteries.
Very bad news. Chronic elevation of IL-6 is highly destructive to the delicate lining of your blood vessels, the endothelium. It actively accelerates atherosclerosis, the buildup of plaque.
We also see the effects on the nervous system, right? That perpetual fight or flight state.
Correct. Isolated individuals show clear signs of sympathetic nervous system hyperactivation. This shows up biologically as significantly reduced heart rate variability. That HRV we talked about. The system loses its flexibility.
Getting in their blood pressure.
A measurable elevation in resting blood pressure. Lonely individuals register about 3.7 millimeters of mercury higher for their baseline systolic pressure. That's a concrete physical consequence of emotional distress.
We have to address the causation question here. Is the isolation directly harming the heart through biology, or is it mostly because isolation encourages poor health behaviors?
It's both. And the research gives us great clarity on the split. Mediation analyses suggest that the behavioral factors, things like poor sleep, less exercise, more substance use, and critically lower adherence to medical treatment, they explain about 21% of the link between isolation and mortality.
So 21% is behavioral, but that means almost 80% is still unexplained by those factors. So the direct biological effects are still the main driver.
That's right. And that direct biological link is supported by modern genetic techniques. A 2024 Mendelian randomization study found a modest but causal link between loneliness and hypertension. So while loneliness definitely degrades your behavior, it also independently drives physiological damage.
Okay, so the ultimate practical guidings here, since the risk is so high, it must be about strategy. Is it just about having more friends? Does quantity beat quality?
Absolutely not. The research is very clear on this. Quality over quantity.
So what does quality look like?
Having varied types of supportive relationships, family, friends, community groups, that shows the strongest mortality benefit. And critically, you have to identify detrimental relationships.
You mean toxic relationships?
Or even just ambivalent ones. Relationships that are characterized by high levels of both positive and negative interaction. They actually predict worse cardiovascular outcomes than just having a few clearly supportive ties.
So it's better to remove those mixed or toxic relationships than to tolerate them just to have a higher number of social contact.
100%. The goal is high quality, supportive ties, not just a full social calendar. And the source has highlighted a really potent two-in-one invention to build this.
Let me guess, volunteering.
The data on volunteering is exceptional. Volunteering for a minimum of 100 hours per year is associated with a dramatic 44% reduced mortality in large studies like the Health and Retirement Study.
But there's a huge caveat on that, right? The motivation matters.
The motivation is critical. The benefit is only seen when the motivation is other-oriented, meaning it's focused on genuine altruism and social contribution. If motivation is self-oriented, like, you know, boosting your resume or just looking good, the benefit disappears.
Okay, let's move into Tier B now. These are interventions with strong evidence for what we call surrogate endpoints, like blood pressure, but they don't yet have the long-term hard outcome data to be in Tier A.
We're going to start with breathing exercises. This is maybe the most accessible and lowest cost tool we'll discuss today.
A powerful zero cost intervention. And the meta-analyses are just remarkably consistent on this.
They are. Intentionally slowing your breathing down to a rate of about 5 to 6 breaths per minute consistently reduces blood pressure.
And what's the effect size we see across the board in the randomized controlled trials?
The consensus, which was reinforced by the 2024 GARG meta-analysis of 15 RCTs, is a systolic blood pressure reduction of about 7 mmHg and about 3 to 4 mmHg for diastolic.
7 millimeters of mercury. Now, that might not sound revolutionary, but in cardiovascular epidemiology, a population-wide 5 mmHg drop in systolic pressure is often estimated to lead to a 25% reduction in major cardiovascular complications.
So this seemingly modest, repeatable result is highly, highly clinically relevant.
The key is understanding why that specific rate, 5 to 6 breaths per minute, is so effective. It's not just a random number.
Not at all. It's specifically targeting the body's intrinsic cardiovascular self-regulation system, the baroreflex.
Okay, let's define the baroreflex.
So the baroreflex is a critical high-speed feedback loop. You have these specialized stretch receptors in your carotid arteries and your aorta, and they continuously monitor your blood pressure.
So it's like a stability governor for your blood pressure.
A perfect way to put it. If pressure rises, the baroreflex instantly signals the brain to lower your heart rate and relax your blood vessels and vice versa.
And in people with hypertension, that governor gets stiff and slow?
Exactly. When the baroreflex becomes sluggish or insensitive, that independently predicts a higher risk of future cardiac events.
So how does slow breathing fix that?
Slowing your breath to that 5 to 6 cycle per minute rate, which is often the body's natural resonance frequency, it does two things. First, it maximizes parasympathetic, or rest and digest, nervous system activation.
And second?
Second, and more importantly, that frequency synchronizes with the natural low-frequency oscillations in blood pressure called Mayer waves.
So you're basically hacking into the body's internal rhythm to retune that pressure sensor.
Yes, you are normalizing the sensitivity of that pressure sensor.
Yeah.
By synchronizing your respiratory rhythm with these natural blood pressure waves, slow breathing acts as a cardioprotective adaptation. It's effectively training the baroreflex to become more flexible and responsive again.
Is there data on that?
There is. One mechanistic RCT showed slow breathing acutely increased baroreflex sensitivity in hypertensive patients. It boosted it from 5.8 to 10.3 milliseconds per mmHg.
That's a profound physiological enhancement using nothing but your own breath. So for the listener who wants to implement this, what's the precise protocol?
It requires consistency, 10 to 15 minutes per session, ideally daily. You want to aim for a minimum of 45 minutes total for the week.
And how should you breathe?
The key is to emphasize nasal breathing. Your nasal passages produce about 6 times more nitric oxide, which, as we discussed with saunas, is a potent local vasodilator. It relaxes blood vessels.
And the pattern.
You want to have a consciously prolonged exhalation. That's the part of the breath cycle that most strongly engages the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic system. And you need to be patient. Durable blood pressure effects usually take about 3 to 5 weeks of consistent practice.
Okay. Now we have to address the cautionary tale here. The issue of industry influence. If this mechanism is so strong, why did the research on commercial breathing devices prove so unreliable?
This is a textbook lesson in scientific scrutiny. Devices like Respirate, which basically just guide you to that 5-6 breath rate, they were heavily marketed based on manufacturer-sponsored trials.
And those trials showed great results.
They consistently reported impressive systolic blood pressure reductions of 10 to 15 mmHg, but...
But when independent researchers tested them...
When independent researchers conducted 4 rigorous, double-blind, sham-controlled trials, the highest standard of evidence, they consistently found no beneficial effects beyond the placebo or the sham treatment.
So we have to assume that any benefits from guided breathing are just a result of sustained behavioral compliance, not because the device itself is doing anything magical.
Precisely. The technique works, but the commercial gadgets don't necessarily add any unique physiological boost. The intervention is accessible to everyone for free. The lesson for you is simple. You don't need a gadget. You just need to adhere to the proven technique.
And the overall limitation for breathing, the reason it's in Tier B and not Tier A.
The critical caveat remains. Despite all this strong, consistent data for reducing blood pressure, our surrogate marker, there are NO studies that show this practice leads to a reduction in hard cardiovascular events, like heart attacks or strokes.
So we're relying on an educated guess, an extrapolation from the blood pressure reduction.
We are, and that's why it has to be in Tier B.
Okay, let's talk about the more abstract factors, starting with purpose in life. Or ikigai, the Japanese concept of having a reason to live. The observational link here is undeniable.
It is. The Cohen 2016 meta-analysis, which was a huge systematic review covering over 136,000 people, found that a high sense of purpose was associated with a 17% reduced risk of cardiovascular events.
A 17% reduction. That's a significant protective factor, although, as you said, all the data here is observational.
Correct.
Did we see that same strong sex difference that we saw with social connection?
We absolutely did. The effect is consistently stronger, and in many of the individual studies, it's only statistically significant in men.
So going back to that Japanese ikigai study.
That study found a protective hazard ratio of 0.86 for cardiovascular mortality in men, but not in women. And the effect was most powerful among unemployed or retired men, which, again, just reaffirms that critical link between lost professional identity and increased cardiovascular risk.
So if the association is so strong, does the research identify a direct biological mechanism? Yeah. Is having a sense of purpose directly making your heart healthier?
The evidence suggests that purpose is primarily a behavioral motivator, not a direct biological modulator.
Meaning
that purposeful individuals just show significantly healthier habits. They have 24% lower odds of being physically inactive, 33% lower odds of developing sleep problems, and they're much better about preventative health behaviors like going for regular checkups.
So purpose acts as a behavioral framework that just compels you to make better choices, and then it's those choices that protect your heart.
Correct. When researchers adjust their statistical models to account for these behaviors, physical activity, diet, sleep, the direct biological effect of purpose often becomes non-significant. Purpose gives you the reason to take care of yourself, but the healthy behaviors are the mechanism of heart protection.
And the major limitation here, because it's all observational, is the classic chicken and egg problem, reverse causation.
That's the main scientific hurdle. We can't definitively rule out that people who are inherently healthier people without chronic illness or disability just naturally feel more purposeful. So good health facilitates purpose rather than purpose generating good health.
But the sheer consistency of this link across so many different global cultures gives us confidence that purpose is a powerful health factor.
It does.
So it sounds great to have purpose, but how do you actually cultivate it as an intervention? Is it just about volunteering again?
Well, volunteering is the most actionable advice with hard outcome data. We talked about that 44% reduced mortality for people doing over 100 hours a year. But the key is the intentionality behind it.
Right, the other-oriented motivation.
Exactly. The research suggests you should focus on activities that use your unique skills in a way that benefits other people. Cultivating purpose is about finding meaningful roles that give you a sense of contribution and efficacy, whether that's mentoring, teaching, community organizing, not just busy work.
Next up, we have meditation and mindfulness. This is an area of massive popular interest, and it generates a lot of promising surrogate data, which is why it's in Tier B.
The data on physiological impact is pretty robust. Meta-analyses consistently show systolic blood pressure reductions of around 6.3 mmHg compared to controls.
And that's why the AHA gave it a Class I recommendation back in 2017, suggesting it may be considered as an adjunct to standard care.
It is. But the big caution here revolves around one single extraordinary trial that dramatically and maybe unrealistically inflated the potential benefits. This is known as the Schneider trial.
The Schneider trial. What did it find?
So the Schneider 2012 randomized controlled trial looked at transcendental meditation, or TM, in African-American adults who already had coronary heart disease.
And the results were impressive.
Astonishing. And frankly, almost unbelievable. The TM group showed a 48% risk reduction in the composite endpoint of death, heart attack, and stroke over a 5.4-year follow-up.
a 48% reduction. That kind of benefit for a non-drug intervention, I mean, that surpasses most conventional treatments. That immediately raises a red flag in the scientific community.
It does. And we have to treat that 48% number with extreme caution.
Why?
Because of the conflict of interest. The trial was conducted by investigators who had direct, deep organizational ties to the Transcendental Meditation Movement and its associated university.
And the result has never been replicated.
It stands completely alone. No other independent meditation trial has ever come close to replicating a hard outcome reduction of that magnitude. The AHA specifically called this out, demanding independent replication by unbiased researchers before this result could be considered definitive.
And that replication has never happened.
It is not. So until it does, we have to classify that 48% outcome as promising, but completely unproven. And what's more, other research has challenged one of the major proposed mechanisms of how meditation is supposed to work.
How so?
Well, a 2021 meta-analysis looked into whether meditation improved autonomic balance, which is usually measured by an increase in resting heart rate variability, or HRV.
Yeah.
And they found that when they properly controlled for the natural slowing of the breath that happens when you meditate, meditation itself was not efficacious for increasing resting HRV.
So this suggests that if you're getting an HRV benefit from your meditation practice, it might just be the result of the slow breathing component, which we already know works, and not the mindfulness component itself.
Right. The blood pressure reduction appears genuine, probably from reduced stress and sympathetic nervous system activity. But the deeper claims of superior autonomic improvement beyond just controlled breathing have been undermined by more rigorous analysis.
Okay, moving into Tier B. We're looking at environmental factors. The research here involves huge cohorts, hundreds of millions of people, but the statistical problems, like confounding and selection bias, are massive scientific hurdles.
They are. Let's start with nature exposure. The good news here is that the research has created a very clear, actionable threshold for you.
Which is?
Studies consistently find that spending at least 120 minutes a week in nature, that's just 2 hours, is the optimal threshold for robust general health and well-being outcomes.
So below 2 hours, the benefits aren't reliably detected.
Right. And above about 300 minutes or 5 hours, the benefits start to plateau.
And that 120 minutes doesn't have to be all at once. It'd be one long hike or a bunch of short walks throughout the week. That flexibility is a huge practical advantage.
For sure. And the evidence for this comes from these massive cohort studies that use advanced environmental metrics. They use that normalized difference of vegetation index, the NDVI, that we defined earlier.
The satellite measure of greenness near your home.
Exactly. And large-scale meta-analyses covering over 100 million people in total consistently show that even a small increase, a 0.1 increase in the NDVI within 500 meters of where you live, is associated with a tangible 2-3% lower CVD mortality.
So the greenness of your neighborhood is an independent predictor of your longevity. The environment where you live is literally influencing your heart health.
That's the takeaway. The proposed mechanisms fall into 3 buckets. First is stress reduction. Nature exposure is linked to lower urinary epinephrine levels, which indicates less sympathetic activity.
Okay, what's second?
Second is improved air quality. Greener areas usually have less particulate matter. And third is activity promotion. Green spaces just encourage you to get out and walk and exercise.
But the challenge we have to confront here is selection bias. It's incredibly difficult to separate the greenness effect from the wealth effect.
And that is the scientific Gordian knot. People who live in greener areas are often wealthier, better educated, more proactive about their health. They're just healthier to begin with.
And researchers try to control for that.
They use sophisticated statistical adjustments for income, smoking, education. But even with those controls, you can't fully eliminate the potential for that kind of bias.
And yet, the consistency of this finding across these vast international cohorts has convinced the scientific community to label this as convincing evidence, even for observational data.
Right. That consensus just speaks volumes about the size of the signal they're finding. And we can also look at the specific practice of Shinrin-yoku, or forest bathing.
The Japanese practice of just spending quiet, reflective time in a forest.
Exactly. And studies show it has immediate acute effects. A 3-4 mmHg drop in blood pressure and a clear shift toward parasympathetic activation.
And this practice is actually integrated into their healthcare system.
It is. Japan has over 60 certified forest therapy bases where the location has been scientifically vetted to maximize these relaxation effects. And we also know that combining factors is best.
How so?
Forest walking produces stronger acute cardiovascular effects than just passively viewing a forest or walking in a city.
We've covered the temperature spectrum in Tier A with heat. Now let's go to the opposite end, and the biggest example of hype versus evidence in our sources, cold exposure.
And this lands squarely in Tier C.
The contrast here is just so stark.
It is. Cold exposure, ice baths, cold plunges, the Wim Hof method, it has enormous popular and media interest. Yet it has the weakest cardiovascular evidence base of any factor we've looked at today.
So what does that evidence vacuum look like for cardiovascular outcomes?
It's defined by a total lack of long-term outcome data. There are no long-term outcome studies linking intentional cold exposure to a reduction in hard CVD events or overall mortality, period.
So all the research is just small, short-term stuff.
The vast majority is small, acute physiological studies, often with fewer than 50 people. And systematic reviews consistently flag a high risk of methodological bias in those studies.
And even the more rigorous recent trials haven't supported the big claims.
That's right. A 2024 randomized controlled trial on the Wim Hof method in young, healthy people found no significant improvements in long-term cardiometabolic markers, resting blood pressure, or stress test responses. The claimed cardiovascular benefits just have not been verified by high-quality, independent research.
But people always talk about the mechanistic findings, like brown fat activation. Why don't those translate into proven long-term protection?
So while brown adipose tissue activation and that acute norepinephrine release are real physiological responses, their translation into clinical cardiovascular protection over decades is completely unproven.
And worse, some studies show negative responses.
Exactly. Clinical studies on hypertensive men show negative responses to cold exposure. They have higher, more dangerous blood pressure spikes and an increased overall cardiac workload compared to healthy controls.
And that leads us directly to the critical need to discuss the acute safety risks, especially for our target audience, who may have underlying cardiovascular risk factors.
The risks are non-trivial, and they demand caution. Sudden immersion into cold water triggers the cold shock response,
which is
simultaneous, sharp spikes in both your blood pressure and your heart rate. And for someone with pre-existing coronary plaque, that can be very dangerous.
It can cause a coronary artery spasm.
Yes. That dramatic sympathetic surge increases the risk of coronary artery spasm, where the arteries supplying blood to your heart suddenly and severely constrict. That can lead to acute ischemia or even heart attack.
And what's the most dangerous, though maybe less common, physiological risk?
It's a phenomenon called autonomic conflict. This happens because cold shock triggers two opposing signals at the same time. You have the massive sympathetic stress response, adrenaline, high heart rate, high blood pressure, and you have the parasympathetic diving reflex, which is trying to slow your heart down.
When those two powerful opposite signals compete,
they can dangerously destabilize the heart's electrical system and predispose you to a lethal arrhythmia.
So given the lack of outcome data and the presence of these demonstrable acute risks, the position is clear.
The position is Tier C. The American Heart Association cautions against cold exposure for anyone with a history of cardiac issues, unstable angina, or uncontrolled hypertension. Cold exposure remains optional at best and potentially harmful for a patient population.
All right. We have completed the deep dive into the evidence for these non-traditional factors. We've covered everything from that 63% SCD reduction in Finland to the arrhythmic risks of ice baths. Let's synthesize this. Let's create a definitive evidence hierarchy review for the listener.
We can lay it out in a distilled comparison table based on scientific rigor, effect size, and outcome data.
Go for it.
At the top, in Tier A, highest confidence, we have sauna unbelievably strong heart outcomes, but limited by that single finish cohort, and social connection heart outcomes, massive sample sizes, and a risk comparable to smoking.
So those are the two highest yield non-traditional additions.
They are. Then in Tier B, promising surrogate, we have purpose, meditation, breathing, and nature exposure.
These all have consistent, strong observational data or excellent evidence for surrogate markers like blood pressure, but we lack the independent long-term RCTs showing they actually reduce events.
Exactly. And then at the bottom, in Tier C, hype caution, we have cold exposure, no hard outcomes, weak evidence, and well-documented acute safety concerns for anyone with cardiac issues.
The key strategic insight here is that for you, the listener, who is trying to optimize cardiovascular health, the highest return on investment beyond the foundation of diet and exercise comes from leveraging these two unexpected domains, controlled heat therapy and the active, conscious cultivation of supportive social ties.
And we can increase the efficiency of these by finding synergistic benefits interventions that hit two targets at once. A key example is combining sauna and exercise.
What's the benefit there?
An 8-week RCT found that using the sauna after your workout supplemented the cardiorespiratory fitness gains you got from the activity alone. It also provided additional systolic blood pressure reduction and helped further lower cholesterol. The combination appears to be additive.
We also saw powerful synergy in the environmental and social spheres.
Absolutely. Nature plus activity. As we noted, intentional forest walking produces stronger effects than urban walking or just passively looking at a forest. The psychological benefits of the environment get boosted by the physiological benefits of movement.
And the ultimate synergy?
Is volunteering. It's a powerful two-in-one. It provides social contact, which is tier A, and a sense of purpose, which is tier B.
And the research also suggested a synergy between breathing and meditation.
It did. The finding that exhale-emphasized breathing sometimes outperformed mindfulness meditation for mood suggests that breath awareness and control might be the fundamental active ingredient driving many of the benefits that we attribute to general mindfulness.
So focusing on the breath just simplifies the path to achieving those benefits.
It does.
Okay, so for the listener, the learner, what are the final prioritized actionable recommendations we can offer, strategic additions to their existing foundation of health?
Based on the rigor of these sources, the evidence points toward three high-priority additions. Number one.
Social connection. This is a non-negotiable cardiovascular intervention. Prioritize quality over quantity. Ruthlessly prune those ambivalent relationships and proactively plan for meaning and connection if retirement is on your horizon. Remember that 61% increased risk for isolated men.
Okay. Number two.
Breathing is the highest value for your time and money. Commit to 10 to 15 minutes a day at that 5 to 6 breaths per minute rate. You're installing a measurable cardioprotective Baroreflex adaptation with zero financial cost.
And the third priority.
Sauna. If you have access, aim for 4 more times a week for that optimal 63% reduction, 15 to 20 minutes per session. And even if you can't do that, 2 to 3 sessions a week still provides a meaningful, documented cardiovascular benefit.
And the final word on the most controversial factor. Cold exposure.
Apply maximum caution. Scream first, start slow, and avoid it completely if you have any history of cardiac issues, uncontrolled hypertension, or unstable angina. The benefits are currently undemonstrated by high-quality long-term research, and the acute risks are real. Let's quickly wrap up with the 3 central takeaways from this deep dive into the second tier of cardiovascular factors.
First, the research strongly supports that sauna and actively cultivated social connection hold the most evidence-based potential for reducing hard cardiovascular events. This moves these factors out of the realm of, you know, lifestyle philosophy and into quantifiable medicine.
Second takeaway.
Slow breathing practice is a powerful, low-cost intervention. It consistently and measurably improves blood pressure and Baroreflex sensitivity, validating its role as a necessary daily routine for vascular health.
And final.
And finally, the evidence for highly popular factors like cold exposure and meditation, specifically when you're looking at hard endpoints like heart attacks and strokes, it remains preliminary. It often rests on single conflicted trials, and that demands continued scientific caution and independent validation before we can call them tier A.
This deep dive shows that the most potent interventions are often found where you least expect them, in a sauna, in a conversation, or in the simple conscious control of your breath. These non-traditional factors are powerful additions that complement but do not replace the foundation of conventional lifestyle management and medical care.
But for those willing to invest the effort beyond the basics, the evidence clearly guides us to prioritize heat exposure and genuine human connection as the keys to optimal cardiovascular resilience.
Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me, that's Y-U-D-A.me.